Hi, I'm Eric Willingham. I'm the social media developer here at Family Talk, and I would like to wish you a Merry Christmas.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's Christmas edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Dr. Meg Meeker, along with your host, psychologist and best-selling author, Dr. James Dobson. And Dr. Dobson, as you know, throughout this month, we're going to be airing the best programs from this past year, and today's program definitely fits that criteria.
Oh, it's right at the top, Dr. Meeker. Dr. Ben Carson was one of my favorite guests throughout this year, and we did three programs with him for that reason. I really enjoyed meeting with him and his wife, Candy, and in fact, while we were recording the programs, Candy Carson knitted a beautiful flower for my granddaughter, Lucy. Oh. And she was sitting over at the side all the time we were talking. In all my years on the radio, no one has ever done that for me before.
A woman after my own heart. I'm a knitter as well. So kudos to Candy. That's great.
You would like her. Dr. Ben Carson is a great man of God and a great physician. Many of our listeners may know that he's seriously considering a run for president. In fact, ABC reported that he had already committed, but I haven't seen anything to affirm that or confirm that. We had him on the program a few months ago before he was considering a serious run for the presidency, and I asked him about his ambitions along with many other questions related to our country. I just think our conversation was fascinating, and obviously others did too, because it ranked very high on the list of programs that we did this last year. To make it clear, we're a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and Family Talk cannot endorse a political candidate. And that's not what we're doing today. This program was one of the best of the year, and we talked about many things, especially Dr. Carson's childhood and the country, the nation. And we're re-airing our interviews because, in a sense, the people that demanded it.
Yes, wonderful. Well, let me go ahead and introduce our guest to our audience, just in case there's some people out there who don't know Dr. Ben Carson. He's just recently retired as the Director of Pediatric Neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins after 35 years of service. During his tenure at the hospital, he became the first neurosurgeon in history to successfully separate conjoined twins joined at the head. That's remarkable. He's also the recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which is the highest civilian honor in the United States, and that was given to him by President George W. Bush. I could fill an entire program with this man's credentials, but I want to stop there so we can actually get to today's broadcast. So let's get to the program now. Here's Dr. James Dobson and Dr. Ben Carson on today's Best Of edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
You know, as people are about to hear, we're going to learn about his childhood in a deprived circumstance. And I mean, it is fascinating to hear the journey he's been on. Dr. Ben Carson, you're really all over the place. You sometimes speak three or four times a week, don't you?
Yes, I have been doing even more than that before I asked to cut back.
You're cutting back? Not much, you haven't. What made you leave the academic setting? Because I did the same thing. What led you to do it?
Well, somebody told me that neurosurgeons die early. And I didn't believe it, so I wrote down the names of the 10 last neurosurgeons I knew who died, calculated the average age of death, and it was 61.
My goodness.
And I decided that if I was still alive, I would retire when I was 61.
And it really was a calculated thing about
it was planned.
What you wanted to do with the rest of your life.
Well, actually, I thought, you know, having worked extremely hard, close to 15,000 neurosurgical cases, and, you know, a lot of other things, too. I thought I would become a much better golfer, learn how to play the organ, and learn some new languages. I bought all these Rosetta Stones. I was all set to relax. But I think the good Lord had a little different plan in mind for me.
Hmm. You're married to Candy, who's here in the studio with us. Candy, they can't hear you, but greetings. We're glad to have you here, too. She's not near a microphone, so I'll have to ask you. She travels with you most of the time, is that right?
Yes, she's with me 90% of the time.
You have three grown children.
Yes.
And two granddaughters.
That's correct.
Your three grown children are all men. They were boys.
One's an engineer. One is an entrepreneur. And one is an accountant.
Ah.
Nobody wanted to go into medicine, but one of them married a doctor.
Is that right? That's close enough, isn't it? Well, I want to talk about so many things with you, and we have limited time. I don't want to waste a minute of it. Many people have heard about your background, about your childhood, but many have not. Can we go back and start
sure.
with that? Take us to the early days when you lived in abject poverty
sure.
as a young child.
Well, you know, I have to start with my mother, who was one of 24 children and got married when she was 13.
No, not 24.
Yes. There were families like that in rural Tennessee back in those days. There were several early deaths. But at any rate, at age 13, she married my father, who was much older than her. They moved to Detroit. She discovered some years later that he was a bigamist, had another family. And that, of course, resulted in a divorce. But she only had a third grade education. And she had the responsibility of trying to raise us in the inner city, Detroit. And then later on, we moved to Boston so that she could have some support from her older sister and brother-in-law, who lived in a very typical tenement in Boston.
How well did you know your father?
Well, you know, the divorce occurred when I was 8. So pretty well. You know, like all little boys, you know, you just love your father. Mm-hmm. You kind of idolize your father. And, of course, I was devastated. And, you know, my brother and I prayed constantly that, you know, Daddy would come back home. It was really only much later in life that I realized that it was probably a good thing that he never came back because, you know, he was involved in alcohol and drugs and women. And women are okay, but you only one of them, you know. So it was a problem with the way his lifestyle. And that probably would have had a very deleterious effect on me and who I became.
It would be a reasonable question to ask how you survived and have gone on to accomplish the things you have in that kind of dire poverty and without a father. But the answer is very clear. It was your mother.
My mother refused to be a victim and never made excuses, but more importantly, never accepted excuses from us, which made us have to try to find solutions for problems. And my brother and I, we lived alone a lot. My mother would go to work, particularly after we returned from Boston and went back to Detroit. She would go to work at 5 in the morning and not get back home until after midnight, going from job to job to job.
So you came home to an empty house.
We sometimes didn't see her all week.
How come the gangs didn't get a hold of you?
The good Lord protected. Plus, you know, she gave us enough assignments, you know, in addition to our schoolwork, we would be okay. But I think the real key was I was a terrible student. My brother was a terrible student. And she was alarmed, and she figured that our lives would turn out just like hers, and she couldn't stand that thought. And she prayed to God for wisdom, and God gave it to her. In her opinion, we didn't think it was wise at all, but turning off TV, allowing us to watch only 2 or 3 TV programs during the week, and with all that spare time, we had to read 2 books apiece from the library and submit to her written book reports, which she couldn't read, but we didn't know that. But, you know, it gave her a way of knowing that we were doing what we were supposed to be doing. And we had to do it. In the beginning, we hated it, absolutely thought it was child abuse. But after a while, I actually started enjoying reading those books because I began to know stuff that other kids didn't know. And I was so tired of everybody teasing me and calling me dummy that I just pretty soon started wanting to read books. Pretty soon it got to the point where my mother said to me, Benjamin, put that book down and eat your food. I was always reading. And in the space of a year and a half, I went from the bottom of the class to the top of the class. My brother had the same experience. And it just made a tremendous difference in the trajectory of our lives. You know, she really didn't have to do a lot at that point.
Are you being modest when you say you were a bad student?
I mean,
when you consider, again, what you've done academically, that's hard for us to understand.
I was the butt of all the jokes about being a dummy. I was always the first one to sit down in a spelling bee. I can remember vividly the day we were having an argument in the schoolyard about who was the dumbest person in the class, and then it rapidly extended to the dumbest person in the world, and I was the subject.
So you were subjected to bullying?
Yes.
How much did that hurt you, and were you angry about it?
I wasn't angry because I thought I was stupid, too. So
you accepted it.
Yeah. But I'll tell you, what really happened is I started reading those books, and I started knowing stuff that other people didn't know. I got so excited. I was saying, wow, I can now know stuff that they don't know.
Is that where the love of learning and the lightning struck in your life and in your mind?
I think that was a big part of it.
And how old were you then?
I was like 11. But, you know, I started the reading program when I was 10. By the time I reached age 12, I had gone from the bottom of the class to the top of the class. Same students who used to laugh and call me names were coming to me asking me for the solutions now. And it was a tremendous metamorphosis that occurred.
That's a thrill when you have been ridiculed like that, to suddenly discover that you can learn too.
Absolutely.
And you give your mom the credit for that.
Absolutely. It was her vision. And she understood because she looked around her. And the homes where she worked, the homes that she cleaned, they were beautiful homes, wealthy people. And then you come back to where we lived, you know, it was abject poverty. And she sort of made the correlation in her mind. She said, these people do well. They don't look at a lot of TV. They read a lot. They study and they plan. She says, I bet if my boys do that, they can be successful.
Why did she never learn to read? Or did she later?
Well, later in life, she taught herself to read, got her GED. In fact, she got her GED the same year I got my high school diploma.
Is that right?
And she went on to college. And she got an honorary doctorate degree, so she's Dr. Carson.
Is
too.
That right? Absolutely. She's still living?
She's still living.
Yes. And you went on to Yale then. How'd you get into Yale? I mean, that's not an easy thing to accomplish.
It's not an easy task, but, you know, I did well in school except for 1 year. My sophomore year, I got caught up with the peer pressure stuff and my grades dropped. But other than that, I was a terrific student. You know, I got the highest scores on the SAT that anybody in Detroit had gotten in 20 years. I think that was really from reading a lot, and also I took Latin, so you could figure out what words meant. And, you know, I was the city executive officer in ROTC, the highest ranking officer for the city of Detroit. And, you know, had gotten in science fairs and won prizes and just gotten involved in a lot of extracurricular activities. So the year that I got into Yale was the first year that they took any substantial number of minorities. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the admissions committee was looking at where I came from, who I was, the tremendous progress that had been made. And they said, you know, we're going to take a chance on this guy.
And they did.
And they did. You know, I must say, I mean, it was quite a culture shock. Coming from my environment, going to the ivy-covered walls of a school like Yale where, you know, the dining rooms were paneled in mahogany and you had real china and silver and paintings on the
You'd
wall.
You'd never experienced
Oriental
that,
rugs.
Right?
And I said, what is this all about? You know, I was just overwhelmed. Never imagined that one day I would sit on the board of trustees of the same university.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And you had the grades and academic record to be accepted into medical school at Michigan, right?
I did, although, you know, my first semester at Yale was pretty traumatic because I wasn't ready for it. I thought that I could do the same thing I did in high school, goof around and then study a day before the exam and get an A. And it didn't work, and particularly in chemistry, and I was failing chemistry. In fact, there was no way I was going to pass. Even if I got an A on the final, I was still going to fail. That's how bad it was. The professor was either very kind or very sadistic. I don't know which. He said, for those students who are failing, I will count their final exam double.
Really?
So, like, you had, like, one last hurrah, one chance, even though how could you possibly get through it? I sat down with that chemistry book the night before the final, and I just said, Lord, I always thought you wanted me to be a doctor, but obviously if I fail chemistry, I'm not going to get into medical school. So could you show me what it is you really want me to do? Or alternatively and preferably work a miracle. And, you know, I was going to memorize that whole chemistry book that night. Of course, I fell asleep. And I dreamed I was in an auditorium by myself. There was a nebulous figure working out chemistry problems on the board. I awakened very early in the morning. The dream was so vivid in my mind. I picked up my chemistry book. I looked up the stuff I was dreaming about. When I went to take the exam the next day, and I opened the exam book, I couldn't believe it. The first problem was one of the ones I had dreamed about. And the next one, and the next one, and the next one, and the next one. I aced the exam. I was one of the first people out of there. And I just said, Lord, thank you for doing that. I said, you'll never have to do that for me again. And that made me a serious student.
Let's backtrack on that a bit. Where did you come to know Christ?
Well, I think the real key for me was when I was 14 years old. And, you know, I had a horrible temper. And I would go after people with baseball bats.
Well, I ask you, if you were angry, you said no. Did that come later?
No, as a child, I just would fly off the handle at minimal provocation.
And you even tried to stab a kid, didn't you?
When I was 14, another teenager angry at me, I had a large camping knife. I tried to stab him. And fortunately for me, he had on a large metal belt buckle under his clothing, and the knife blade struck it with such force that it broke. And he fled in terror, but I was more horrified than he was, recognizing that I was trying to kill somebody over nothing. And I had turned things around academically by then, but I realized that there was no way I was going to realize my dream of becoming a physician with a temper like that. And I locked myself in the bathroom, and I just fell on my knees, and I said, Lord, I can't control my temper. I've tried everything. I can't control it. And unless you control it, you know, my life is essentially over. And there was a Bible there, and I picked it up, opened it to the book of Proverbs. And there were all these verses about fools and about anger. And it seemed like they were all written about me. And for 3 hours, I stayed in that bathroom, and I came to an understanding that to lash out at somebody, to punch somebody in the face, was not a sign of strength. It was a sign of weakness. It meant you could be easily controlled by the environment and by other people. And I also came to understand that the reason I was angry is because I was selfish. Somebody was in my space. They had done something to me. They did, you know, it was always about me. And I said, take yourself out of the center of the equation. Let it be about somebody else. Look at things from other people's points of view.
Your mother was a committed Christian?
She was.
And was she praying for you?
Well, she didn't know about that incident. She was at work.
But during that era.
But yes, of course. Absolutely, she was praying for
me. Took you to church.
Absolutely.
And your brother Curtis.
Absolutely. And, you know, that was the last day that I ever had an angry outburst of that nature.
Really?
It never happened again after that. And that really changed my personality, I believe. Some people say you just learn how to hide your anger. But, you know, when the Lord fixes a problem, he doesn't just do a paint job. You know, he fixes it from the inside. And it's actually very difficult for people to make me angry now. And a lot of people have commented, you always seem so calm even when people are attacking you. It's because I've learned how to take myself out of the center of the circle and look at things from other points of view.
You've had a lot of people angry at you, haven't you?
Oh, yes.
Because of the stand you've taken for life and for conservative values and so on.
Absolutely.
And they've called you all kind of names.
Yeah.
And you've been through a lot of racial slurs,
sure,
too.
Absolutely.
Coming through medical school and even as a physician.
Yes.
And it carried you through all of
it
that.
It carried me through that And, you know, I look at those people, particularly the really nasty ones, and I just say, wow, that used to be a cute little baby. I wonder what happened. It helps me to deal with them.
Well, how did you then get into medical school, and how did that come about?
Well, you know, I did well in college and, you know, did well on the standardized test that you have to take to get into medical school. But I didn't do well on the first set of comprehensive exams. In fact, I did so badly that I was sent to see my counselor, and he looked at my record and he says, you seem like an intelligent young man. I bet there's a lot of things you could do outside of medicine. And he tried to convince me to drop out of medical school. He says, you're not cut out for medicine. You're just going to torment yourself and everybody else. And it would be a lot easier if you just drop out. He said, we can help you get into another discipline, another area, so you won't have wasted these 6 weeks. And I just went back to my apartment and I said, Lord, help me to figure this out. Because I'm sure that you want me to be a doctor. I was sure of it after what he did for me with that chemistry test. So I started thinking, what kind of courses do you do well in? What kind of courses do you struggle in? And I realized that I did well in courses where I did a lot of reading, and I struggled in courses where I listened to a lot of boring lectures. Mm-hmm. And there I was listening to 6 to 8 hours worth of boring lectures every day, basically wasting 6 to 8 hours. So I made an executive decision. Skip the boring lectures, and to spend that time reading. The rest of medical school was a snap after that. And when I came back several years later as the commencement speaker, I was looking for that guy because I was going to tell him he wasn't cut out to be a counselor.
But you never told him.
Well, some people are just negative, negative, negative. They can always tell you why something's not going to work, but they never seem to invest any time and effort into how it can work. And that's something that we suffer from in this nation also. People always complaining about things. You know, I myself have talked about the Affordable Care Act and the problems associated with it. But I have come up with an alternative, a very effective alternative that would be much cheaper and put the care in people's own hands.
If you will permit Dr. Ben Carson, who we've been talking to, if you will permit, I'd like to get into that very issue in the next program. We will just continue talking as long as you will stay with us because there is so much that I want to ask you. But as a way of ending this program or this portion of it, describe your relationship with Christ today. Does he continue to walk with you? Has he led you to leave the university, leave academia, and all the whole medical community, and to do what you're doing now? And if so, why do you think so?
I would feel extremely vulnerable if I didn't feel that he was right here by my side every moment, every step of the way. It was that way throughout my medical career. You know, if you had sat me in front of a computer and said, type out the career you want to have, I could not have come up with the kind of career that he gave me. No possibility. And the kind of cases, it was the Lord leading. There was a lot of controversy throughout my career. And things worked out, and I knew that that was the good Lord leading.
Well, I hate to cut in here, but we're out of time for today. Dr. Ben Carson is such an inspiring figure, and I'm really looking forward to the next two programs with him. We've been listening to the first part of a program titled One Nation here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Dr. Meg Meeker, and if you would like more information about Dr. Ben Carson or his book One Nation, please visit our website, drjamesdobson.org, or give us a call at 877-732-6825. But before we go today, I'd like to mention one more thing. For those of you listening, we have some really exciting news. Friends of Family Talk have stepped forward with a very generous matching grant that doubles any gift that we receive from you this month. That means that your donation will reach twice as many families and have twice the impact for the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now is a vital time for the Ministry of Family Talk, as the money we receive before the end of the year sets the stage for the ministry impact we can have in the upcoming new year. We plan the entire year based on the donations that come in from now through December 31st, and we would love to be able to expand and reach more families than ever in 2015. So will you consider giving today? You can donate by visiting drjamesdobson.org, or you can give by calling us at 877-732-6825. Thank you so much for listening today, and we'll see you again next time for part two of One Nation with Dr. Ben Carson, right here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
Family Talk is not affiliated with Focus on the Family.